Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. You are with Ijeoma Oluo, Editor-at-Large at The Establishment, and Erica C. Barnett at thecisforcrank.com, and Knute Berger, columnist with crosscut.com and Seattle Magazine. Hi, everybody.
Hello.
Hey, Bill.
Hello.
Thanks for spending the next hour with us. We're going to figure out what happened this week and what it means, what's it really about. And we'd like to hear from you, listener. You can talk with us during the show on Twitter. The hashtag is KUOWWIR. That's for Week in Review, KUOWWIR. Our Facebook page, KUOW Public Radio. Our email address, weekinreview@kuow.org. And if you're pithy and insightful, then we'll read your comment on the air. Wouldn't that be cool? Okay, let's get right at our top story right now. Once again, Seattle is front and center in America's immigration debate. You know, this week, federal immigration enforcers arrested hundreds of undocumented immigrants in at least a half a dozen states. In Des Moines, south of Seattle, they picked up a 23-year-old man named Daniel Ramirez Medina, who was brought to the U.S. as a child. He is enrolled in President Obama's DACA program, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. So he has status. He's protected. As you may have just heard in our newscast this morning, in Seattle, a federal magistrate declined to release this man. His lawyers wanted him released immediately, and he said, nope, he's still being held. He's got to get a bond hearing from a federal immigration judge. So we'll follow all of that stuff. The question is, if this man is, since he has status under the DACA program, which President Trump has not canceled, why is he being held? Well, the feds claim that Ramirez admitted to having a gang affiliation, and being a gang member would void his DACA protection. His lawyers say that's false. They say somebody altered a note that Ramirez wrote at the detention center, altered it to make it look like he was admitting gang membership. The feds say Ramirez has a gang tattoo on his forearm, and his lawyer says no. The tattoo says La Paz, BCS. La Paz is the capital of the Mexican state of Baja California Sur, BCS. That's where Ramirez was born. So you have this, and beyond that argument is the question, is this arrest a one-off, or is President Trump going after these childhood arrivals? So, more to say there, but what is this story about to you, Ijeoma? I just said a lot of stuff. What's this about?
You know, I think that right now what this is about is, I think it's a unleash of the frustration that ICE agents and as an agency has had at not being able to go after people that they've wanted to go after. And I think right now they're acting with a lot of impunity because they see an administration that they know is not going to hold them accountable to promises that previous administrations have made. I think this is a very egregious abuse, and I think this is a test of how much we as a Seattle community are willing to stand up for what we said we would and all the promises that were made after this election, not only by us as individuals, but by our city and state government as well.
But if it's about ICE agents feeling they've got permission to just go rogue, why are we just talking about one DACA enrollee so far?
Well, I think what a lot of this is I don't even think it's necessarily a targeted campaign against DACA enrollees.
Okay.
It was an opportunity. They were there, right, to serve a warrant on the father.
On his father.
Yeah. And I think that they're just taking whatever opportunities they can. And we're seeing an increase in raids in general around the country. There's so much fear. And I think that that is being done on purpose. I think that right now they're trying to put a lot of fear into our immigrant communities and into especially liberal communities in general, and just to see, you know, kind of what we're going to do. And I think that we need to definitely respond with the amount of alarm that we said we were going to.
To fill that in a little, the feds say they were at this apartment in Des Moines to arrest Ramirez's father, who did state prison time for felony drug trafficking. He's been deported 8 times. They say that Ramirez, the 23-year-old, was sleeping at the apartment, and when they asked him if he had ever been arrested, Ramirez said yes, and then the agent arrested him. Ramirez's lawyer says no, he was handcuffed right after he said he was born in Mexico. Ramirez has no criminal record, and his lawyers say he has a 3-year-old son who's a U.S. citizen. So, Knute, President Obama deported millions of people. So far, does this seem to you like a difference in kind of immigration enforcement? Since so far, again, we're talking about one DACA arrival. And yeah,
right.
Go ahead.
Well,
first of all, I think you have to take in the whole climate. I think in Obama's case, people weren't necessarily alarmed because Obama was trying to find a way that these children could stay, find some kind of status that would protect them. They came into the country undocumented, but through no fault of their own. And there's this, you know, class of people that he was attempting to protect. And at the same time, you know, he wanted to get some kind of comprehensive immigration reform through. So he was working kind of on all sides of the equation. I think with Trump, the sense is, you know, build a wall, ban people from certain countries, you know, really crack down on. And I think there's a question as to how people who are, you know, basically considered innocent in this whole thing, how they're going to be treated. So, I mean, I think there's alarm because of people see something really ugly coming down the pike and don't see that it's being dealt with on the humane end.
Do we know why President Trump hasn't just canceled DACA if that's what he wants to do? He has said in the campaign that he was going to, and then the Republican committee chair seemed to be, you know, saying, we're not in any hurry to get to that.
Well, he has a lot on his plate.
He has a lot on his plate, yes.
I would say, I don't know the answer to that specific question, but pinging off what Knut was saying, the difference that I see between Trump's actions and Obama's actions, Obama was definitely, I mean, he was known as the deporter in chief as well. He was not someone who was afraid to deport people who were here illegally, other than, you know, the people who came through no fault of their own as children. But he had a more targeted approach. He deported people, or targeted people for deportation who had committed felonies, who had committed a certain number of misdemeanors. This action that's going on right now across the country and in, you know, particularly cities that have lots of minorities and lots of people from Mexico, seems, you know, arbitrary in its application, in that it's not people who are necessarily even criminals. But it also seems very targeted toward...
it's not especially targeted toward criminals?
Well, I mean, in this particular case, you know, that we're talking about with Ramirez, he's someone who doesn't have a criminal history.
Yeah, but this is so far one. I mean, we're waiting to see how this goes, but there were hundreds of people caught up over this week in these raids.
The targeting that I see is more in cities that have large Latino populations, as well as cities and counties that are sanctuary cities and counties.
I was going to ask about that.
Such as Seattle and County. I think that it would be a mistake not to consider the possibility that Trump is making an example of Seattle and King County and L.A., just to name two examples, which have both said, we are sanctuary cities. We will not, as you know, a law enforcement agency, target people who are in the country illegally. We won't ask them their immigration status. But Trump is essentially saying, well, that's fine, but ICE can go in and do whatever they want anyway. And that is true.
Yeah. So we have these two real different ways of looking at this. This was one out of many. This is one botched up thing that happened in an apartment in Des Moines, Washington. Or this is, it's no coincidence, Seattle's a sanctuary city, and this is purposeful in some way. Any more thoughts on that before we
move? You know, I think one thing that's really important, I know a lot of people do shy away from the Obama-Trump comparisons when we talk about immigration, but I do think that one comparison we need to make, that one accounting we need to make, is the fact that at the beginning of the Obama administration, he did openly appeal to a lot of this sentiment and, in fact, changed the methodology and how he calculated who was being deported to actually make it look like he was deporting even more people than previous presidents had. That direct appeal to people who are anti-immigration, and the lack of outcry amongst people now who say that they stand for something different, helped lay the groundwork to where we are now, and really helped legitimize that sentiment in general that lasted through 8 years. And now we're seeing this culmination. So I think that we, especially in liberal cities, really need to look at why we were not as outraged when we did see this increase at the beginning of the Obama administration as well, and why we are choosing to be outraged now. Because when this president is gone, this is still going to be an issue. And we need to make sure that we are more consistent in our values values and what we say we stand for.
What's your theory? Why do you think that inconsistency is there?
Well, I think that we like to use a lot of cognitive dissonance. We have our camp and we have their camp. Mm-hmm. And we like to assume that our elected officials are doing the best they can without actually really enforcing that they stand up to the values they say they stand for. We don't like to take that responsibility, but the truth is that you are responsible for your representatives just as they are responsible to you.
Cognitive dissonance, one of my favorite topics about human beings, by the way. Knut, any thoughts?
Oh, I was just going to say that I think the sort of extreme approach that Trump is taking is raising the issue. And, I really agree that it's something that in white liberal Seattle has not been as top of mind. But you're seeing, I think, an education going on about people realizing the whole spectrum of importance. And I think, I'm thinking about some of the protests against Trump that have occurred recently. One of the things that's interesting to me in comparison with, say, protests in the past is that you have an alignment of in the greater Seattle area and in Washington at the state level, you have an alignment between the top political figures in the governor and attorney general. You have, people in the streets protesting on behalf of immigrant rights. And you also have the big corporate interests are finally saying, holy crap.
Amazon, Microsoft,
this is
Boeing in a way.
The golden goose is about to get slain. Mm-hmm. And for better or worse, I think there's a really interesting kind of convergence and education of the general public realizing that a lot of our prosperity relies on thinking of immigrants as a positive force as opposed to a hostile, negative, other force.
That's a good place to pause this. We've got a lot of other things to talk about. The news today, this morning in federal court, this federal magistrate judge did not agree to the lawyer's demand, a request to release Daniel Ramirez Medina. So he's still in immigration detention, even though he had legal status under this DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. The magistrate says that Ramirez has got to request a bond hearing from the federal immigration judge and ought to get one within a week. So we're going to keep following that developing story on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Now, we've got a florist, we've got parental leave, we've got the rights of homeless people in this city, and the rights of the poor Mercer Islanders all coming up ahead. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Erica C. Barnett, as in the C is for crank.com, Ijeoma Alua with The Establishment, Knut Berger, the Mossback with Crosscut and Seattle Magazine. And you, let us know what you're thinking about all this. Twitter, the hashtag is KUOWWIR for Week in Review. Facebook, it's KUOW Public Radio. And by email, weekinreview@kuow.org. Now, number two topic, florist versus gay wedding. This week, the Washington State Supreme Court ruled unanimously against a Richland florist who refused to arrange flowers for a same-sex couple's wedding. Florist Baronel Stutzman claimed that arranging flowers for that wedding would violate her religious beliefs. Now, she said in court that arranging flowers for a Muslim couple is not an endorsement of Islam, that arranging flowers for an atheist couple does not endorse atheism. And I asked her on KOW, why is this different? And she told me about how, to her, regardless of the religion that she views a wedding as a sacrament, as a man-woman thing, and that this she doesn't want. She said she would sell. She's known this couple, by the way, for years. She's been friends with at least one of the couple for 10 years and has knows he's gay, of course, and sells him flowers and all that. But she said, I would sell these people prearranged flowers. I would sell my friend flowers prearranged for the wedding, but I don't want to arrange the flowers for what I think is, she didn't use the word sham wedding, but that was the idea based on her religion. And she's taken it to the Supreme Court. She just lost there this week, and that may go to the U.S. Supreme Court. I ask again, Erica, what is this story about for you?
Well, for me, it's about the fact that, you know, we have an affirmation now and a unanimous affirmation that somebody's personal feelings about another person's behavior, another person's religion, another person's race does not matter if they are in a position of serving the public. I believe that this florist also argued that this was free expression, that she was an artist in,
that's right,
you know, in making these flower arrangements. And, you know, my immediate reaction was, you know, Subway calls their workers sandwich artists, but that doesn't mean they can refuse to provide service to somebody based on their race, religion, sexual orientation, or gender.
Right.
So I think this was a really strong affirmation by the Supreme Court of Washington that, you know, that these arguments are, you know, are and have always been totally spurious, and you can't.
In Washington state, right? Isn't the law different in other states when it comes to sexual orientation?
Yes.
In fact, I think most states, I think Washington is one of about 20.
But I think that the nation is trending in that direction. And uh-huh. I think that if this case does go to the Supreme Court, we have a pretty good precedent in place through this ruling that, you know, that this is an area in which, you know, discrimination is not going to be tolerated the way it has been in the past. Right. And I think that, you know, it's also, I mean, we also have laws at the national level that, and precedent at the national level that says that, you know, religious feelings can, in some cases, dictate what sort of healthcare services, for example, companies will provide. So,
like Catholic-affiliated hospitals?
Catholic-affiliated hospitals, Hobby Lobby. So there's precedent in both directions, but I think the difference is that this is refusal to provide a service that is provided to everybody else in the public, and it's singling out one particular group of people based on their identity, and I think that, you know, that's not going to be upheld at the national level.
Yeah, certainly wasn't in Washington State, to Supreme Court unanimous this week. What, Nijioma, what is this about?
You know, I mean, it's about bigotry, pure and simple. I am a Black queer woman. Right. I'm very familiar my entire life with bigotries. And I think what we need to always remember, this isn't just about flowers. Right. This isn't just, I don't like you, you don't get flowers for your wedding from me, go somewhere else.
Well, it wasn't that she didn't like them, but yes, she didn't like them.
But honestly, no, you really can't like someone and not see them as whole people and want them to have equal
that's
rights.
Interesting.
You know, her claim of friendship is completely false. But what
I think he says I think the man says that they were friends. But anyway, I don't know
friends
them.
Now.
probably not hanging out right now.
I'm sure he thought they were friends.
Yeah, right.
And you know, and I run into that a lot. A lot of people I think are friends until I find out that they don't want me to have the same rights as everyone else in this country. Yeah. I think it's important to remember that this sort of discrimination has long-reaching effects in the day-to-day lives of people who have been historically discriminated against. It has broad impacts behind just whether or not you can get flowers. And I am a mixed race Black woman who's, when my mom and my dad got married, it was illegal in many states. And that sort of denial of services meant that when my mom was giving birth to my brother, they had to bring a doctor in from another hospital because the doctor at that hospital refused to serve her. She spent 3 days in hard labor before they brought in another doctor who would help her. She could have died. My brother could have died. This is what this sort of discrimination can lead to. And it is completely wrong. And we need to stand up for it, even in what seems like the smallest circumstances, because you have to draw a firm line. You don't know where it ends.
Yeah. Can you, I think I know the answer. I wondered whether, the law is in Washington State is clear. I can empathize with a lot of people, whether I agree with them or not. And this woman who I interviewed, Baronelle Stutzman, this florist, she said, there are so many other florists. She didn't feel like she was denying them anything because there are, just imagine if this happened in Seattle, you know. She said most florists will probably give the arrange flowers for this wedding. In her mind, she felt like, well, I'm not, no one's going to die, you know, as opposed to your example. Agree or not, I felt like I can, to me, this is partly about empathy. Even though the law in Washington State is clear, as was upheld again this week.
It is about empathy, but it's also about the environment you create. Mm-hmm. And if you help creating an environment where discrimination against people is okay, that feeds into a system that actually does kill people. And I think we have to remember that we either believe that human beings have equal rights or we don't. And if we start fudging around the edges of that, that's where people's lives are actually endangered.
Well, I also think, I mean, as the court pointed out, this is not a question of whether you can get flowers. That's right. Legally clear. It's not as though, you know, Arlene's could put up a sign that says no gays and the, you know, florist across the street could put up a sign that says gays welcome here. I mean, you don't get to do that with any other class of people. So the issue isn't whether flowers are widely accessible. The issue is whether a public service is provided to all without discrimination.
Yep. That's almost quoting from the judges. That public accommodations laws don't just guarantee access to goods and services. They serve a broader societal purpose of eradicating barriers to equal treatment in the commercial marketplace.
You know, I think we have to be aware of the fact that Washington State and all states, but, you know, we are not exempt as a state from having had terrible discriminatory laws in place at our founding, after our founding, sunset laws. You can go back and look through ordinances.
What's a sunset law?
Sunset law is a law that basically says no black people can live here or be here after dark.
Mm-hmm.
I found an ordinance early in Seattle history that banned Native American women from the wharves of Seattle, specifically between sunset and sundown.
Hmm.
I mean, we banned all Native Americans from Seattle in the early days. I mean, those discriminatory laws are kind of embedded in our pioneer culture, and we've been wrestling with them, and some of those battles have been at the federal level, some of them have been at the local level. And, you know, we're not at the place where everyone has their rights yet.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, you know, that's what this case was about. I mean, kudos to the people who it would have been really easy for these guys just to go across the street and get a flower arrangement they like. Kudos to them for pushing and making the point. And now you have, you know, a legal precedent. And I, you know, agree with Erica about is this a First Amendment issue as far as making art? I mean, what chef doesn't consider themselves an artiste?
Right.
You know,
I think all of us here are artists.
Yeah.
No question about that.
And, it, you know, but using that to justify, you know, discrimination in a public service just doesn't fly. And so I think it's a great decision. And we still have a long way to go to address these kinds of issues.
So U.S. Supreme Court, 8+ Neil Gorsuch. Anybody think this has a chance, this florist?
Oh, yeah. I would think so. I mean, I think that Gorsuch has a record, and the Trump administration is pushing for laws under the umbrella of religious freedom that will allow people to deny services if their conscience dictates in certain circumstances. I don't think the outcome at the national level, given the changes there, are a slam dunk at all.
I asked this florist, Baronelle Stutzman from Richland, what she would do if she lost her case ultimately. And she said that, I said, would you retire? First she said, well, I wouldn't arrange flowers for a same-sex wedding. I said, you mean you'd be civilly disobedient? Or you'd retire or what? She said, well, I guess I just wouldn't do wedding flowers.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, she doesn't have to be in this business.
Nobody
is forcing her to serve the public. There are many businesses that are not public facing. And, you know, I worked in retail for quite a few years, and there were plenty of people that I didn't want to serve because they were jerks to me and they were condescending. And, you know, that doesn't, I don't get the right to say I will serve you and I won't because of my personal feelings about you. And that doesn't become any less true because you say your personal feelings are based on religion.
And she chose a job. This has to do with her being in public accommodation, right? It's not all businesses that are treated the same under the Federal Civil Rights Act. It's hotels and restaurants and theaters and banks and health clubs and stores and wedding flower.
Right. It's
flower
arrangers. It's public facing. Yeah. I can't turn people away from my sandwich shop, and she can't turn people away from her florist.
We'll keep watching. Again, the Washington State Supreme Court, no question about it, unanimously ruling this week against that Richland florist who wouldn't arrange flowers for a same-sex couple's wedding. And here's a thought about the Arlene's Flowers case from a listener, KOW. Cal writes on Facebook, maybe entertainers choosing not to support Trump or anyone else they don't agree with should be forced to perform against their will or face career-ending lawsuits?
Entertainers are not providing a public accommodation. I mean, that gets to the point that you're making about, you know, about the difference between various types of businesses. If I am, you know, if I am a performer, or if I, you know, I don't have to go on another radio station as someone who talks on the radio for part of my living. So it's just a very different type of business. And a performer does have the right to say, to choose, you know, for whom and where he or she performs.
So when Beyonce comes through town, we can't force her to go on KVI and do a...
Although I would love that.
Yeah, who would enjoy it? But yeah. Okay, well, we'll keep watching that one. More of KUOW's Week in Review. Parental leave and whose rights in an unauthorized homeless encampment, and Mercer Island might have to slow their roll or carpool their roll. Coming up. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Have a baby, get 3 months paid leave. This week, the Seattle City Council voted to give city workers up to 12 weeks of paid parental leave, up from 4 weeks, which it used to be. Erica C. Barnett, you're the only non-parent in the room. How would you feel if you worked at the city and your cubicle mate got 3 months paid leave for having an adorable child?
Oh, just love them. Yeah. I think that they should get 12 weeks of leave. I think that, you know, at least, I mean, we are the only country in the developed world that doesn't have any guaranteed maternity leave. So I think it's great that the city is doing this. I also would point out that they added 4 weeks of leave for other purposes, which is really important. So if a family member gets sick, if a loved one gets sick, if you have other family-related needs that aren't related directly to having a child or adopting a child, you can also get time off. And I think that is a really important thing to note, because there are family emergencies that don't involve having a child. I do think, as I've pointed out before, there is an issue that arises with us non-breeders, that we don't get sort of a certain amount of paid time off for work-life balance. Work-life balance is not only about work-child-raising balance.
How would that work? How would a non-breeder work-life balance allocation go?
Well, I'm not in the business of figuring this out. I will conveniently say that. But I do think that, you know, people in America don't get enough time off. And if I'm working at a job, particularly in a small business where some, you know, say two or three of the people that I work with, of the 10 people that I work with, take time off to and take absolutely, you know, justifiable and deserved time off to have a child, I am going to pick up the slack. And I think that 2 weeks of vacation, which is pretty typical in this country, is not enough to provide the same kind of work-life balance to people who don't have children but do have other things in their life that they pursue. That said, I completely think parental leave is a higher priority. And if we're going to sort of go down the hierarchy, I think it's great that the city is providing this leave, and I think that we should extend it to private employers as well.
You mentioned other countries. Don't other countries have a work-life balance policy just because you get more time off? Generic paid time off than you do here?
Yeah.
So they're doing it.
Yeah, other countries do it. And
it's not like you have to apply and say, here's why this is going to be really balancing for me.
Right, here's my mission for my 6 weeks of
vacation. Yeah,
no, I don't think
here's what I'm going to contribute. Yeah.
Right, I don't think we should have to justify that. And I think this country needs a lot more vacation. The years that I have been happiest are years when I've had 6 weeks off and, you know, and been a much more productive worker in those years. So I think that that would be a fine solution. I will say there's a state law that's up right now that would preempt the city from doing this. And so that's something that we need to be watching out for.
Really? That's live in the legislature?
I missed that. Yeah. There's a Republican proposal in the Senate that is moving forward, that moved out of committee, and that actually has bipartisan support that would preempt Seattle from passing, or King County from having a more restrictive and more generous paid leave rule.
Does anyone think that 12 weeks is the limit of city taxpayers' interest in paid parental leave, or could we go to 20 or, you know, 6 months, or I don't know where it is in Seattle?
I mean, other countries have very successfully gone much further. I think it depends on your priorities as a society. I think that would require a big shift I mean, we can't,
even in Seattle,
we can't. Well, we can't even fund education for our kids. So, I mean, getting to fund, you know, more paid leave is something that, that really does require a shift. And as someone who has had to, who has taken paid leave twice to have two separate children, I can say that the
FMLA leave or
FMLA.
Yeah.
And trust me, you know, I had to come back from my first son 3 weeks after giving birth because as the sole breadwinner, I could not afford otherwise. And I think it's important for us to recognize, too, that when we talk about paid leave, we aren't actually talking about vacation. You're talking about the most stressful, exhausting 12 weeks of your life where you're not sleeping, you're not doing anything, your entire life is turned upside down. So when we talk about work-life balance, paid leave to have a child honestly has almost nothing to do with that because you're still just as exhausted, if not more, when you come back from work from that time. That's just basically making sure that we don't have, you know, a society that doesn't value children, that has, you know, messed up family structures, sick parents, sick kids. We've shown that, you know, the well-being of children is determined by how long parents can stay with them after birth, how long parents can breastfeed, things like that. So, you know, it's those are two separate things. I think both are very important, but I think it's really important that we look at those separately because there is absolutely, you could have 20 weeks of paid parental leave and there's still no work-life balance for parents because they come home and they're still working. That's just a basic don't die at work because you're sleeping 30 minutes a day while you're getting used to having a new child that never sleeps.
Poor us, Erica. Being a parent is horrible. Lucky you.
I am childless by choice. I will admit and embrace that. However, you know, I think that 2 weeks of vacation a year also leads to sick people and to unhappy people and to people who are not doing a good job at their jobs. And so, you know, when I talk about work-life balance, like I don't get it because I haven't done it, but I have most of my friends have kids. Most people in the world have kids. You know, I have certainly heard how awful those, you know, first year or however long is. So I don't think that that's in any way the equivalent of taking a vacation. I am just speaking up for the people who are left behind, who are sort of expected to do the jobs of those people because we don't have a system in place where we hire people to do the work of absent parents. And we rely on the people who are left behind to take on an extra job and work an extra 20 hours a week. And that is a real experience that people have that shouldn't be completely discounted by the fact that they don't have children at that moment.
What do you have to say, Dad? Grandpa?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm going through this semi-indirectly because I have 4.5-month-old twin grandkids. And fortunately, my daughter-in-law was able to get several months of leave. And
how'd she do that?
Of course, it was offered through work and
private business,
nonprofit.
Got it.
Yeah, and
am I prying right now? Sorry.
Yeah, and
what kind of nonprofit?
You know, my son.
Are they hiring?
Yeah, I'm just doing a little job search, man.
You know, my son was working for a company that basically didn't offer much in the way, so he had to take a combination of vacation and unpaid leave and things like that. I think one of the things is we know that there's a huge social value in having parents be able to be with their kids, particularly in the early phases. That's a really crucial, and I'm just getting a reminder of that literally, like, constantly watching the interactions and the needs of the grandkids. You know, 12 weeks to me seems to me kind of minimally humane. I think it's a great idea. There are companies around that give people a year or in some cases more.
Doesn't California provide 52 weeks?
That I don't know.
Well, I don't know about that.
Yeah, I don't know.
Could be. And I lived there and I still don't know.
You know, I think we could do a lot more. You mentioned the developed countries. I mean, maybe this is the small part of me that's Scandinavian, you know, but they have such humane and I think sane policies in terms of the kinds of leaves, the kinds of vacation. I think Eric is absolutely right. 2 weeks. And a lot of people don't even take 2 weeks. I think I would like to see a much more broad national level of benefits that address this, so it doesn't necessarily fall on private businesses and whatnot, especially small ones, to solve the problem.
Yeah, and Trump is talking about maternity leave for birth mothers only. So right now at the national level, that conversation is moving in the opposite direction.
Maybe sometime when we're talking about parental stress, we can get at the fact that we put a lot of pressure on ourselves and do it ourselves instead of it taking a village. But I have no standing as a male, especially, but that's a whole other conversation about how tough it is to be a parent. We've got some more to go here on KOW's Week in Review, figuring out what happened this week and why with Knute Berger and Ijeoma Oluo and Erica C. Barnett, and we'll be right back. KOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. I can't hear you talking back to your radio. You have to put your comments someplace where we can read them. You can do that on Twitter right now. Hashtag KOWWIR. Facebook, it's KOW Public Radio. Send us an email, weekinreview@KOW.org, and join the conversation. What is Seattle doing about its homeless population? Well, there's a lot, but one problem's been that the city kicks people out of camping spots where they're not allowed to be, and when they clean the place up, the city's throwing away garbage, but sometimes it's throwing away people's belongings. Civil rights advocates have sued over that, and this week a federal judge, for now, allowed the city to keep on evicting and cleaning as it does while this lawsuit continues. And I ask again, Knute, what is this argument and this lawsuit, what is this story really about to you?
Well, what the story's really about is our collective failure to deal with the homelessness issue.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and the fact that it's growing and that there's a chronic need. And I think part of the problem is that it's not being addressed. I mean, it's being addressed by a lot of people in a lot of different ways, but the scale of how we're addressing it is not meeting the need. In other words, we have literally thousands of people who are homeless, but we don't have organized encampments that can house thousands of people.
So you mean the scale of available places to sleep, for example, not scale of
right.
How scaling up to clean up people's belongings without
That's
throwing
right.
out
I'm
their
talking about,
stuff.
I'm talking about housing people even on a temporary basis, and then the issue. I mean, I understand the issue of not wanting people to be sleeping under freeways and cleaning up messes that are made. You can drive, all over the city and see problems with garbage and stuff strewn around. But I also think this issue, specifically in this case, about what happens to the possessions of people. I don't see how you're helping people if you throw away their tent or their sleeping mm-hmm. bag. One of the numbers that was cited in the case, and the city contests this, but of 968 cleanups in 21 months, and only 7% of people's personal belongings were inventoried. I mean, that suggests a large problem, that you're not just cleaning up these areas and moving people out, but you're taking away some of the basic tools they need to survive.
But why is that and city policy? No, is that compassion? Is that a lack of budget?
That could be all of those. Uh-huh. It could be execution. It could be a lot of different things. So I think that we have encampments in various places that are sanctioned. I think we need more of those. Potentially, we even need larger ones. I think we need some kind of more attention and larger scale that, though temporary, does get people into legitimate shelters.
Erica, the city hired a consultant who, Barbara Poppy, didn't she basically say sanctioning encampments just allows the city to not really move people into stable housing?
She did, and I think there's some tension between Barb Poppy and the city itself on this point. I talked to George Scarola, the city's director of homelessness, and he acknowledged that there was some disagreement between the city and its consultant about the need to actually take care of all these folks in the meantime. Her plan proposes to give people short-term housing vouchers to get them into housing on the private market very quickly. But we haven't, there's question, you know, I would question how well that's going to work given the expensive housing market that we're dealing with. But in any case, it hasn't been implemented yet, and we have thousands of homeless people living on the streets. And to me, the larger story here, in addition to we don't have enough housing, we don't have enough shelter, is it is really, really difficult to site facilities for homeless people in this city. When the mayor proposed doing 4 new encampments, he was only able to find 3 sites, and all 3 have been incredibly controversial. And that's only going to house a few hundred people at most. We don't have lockers for people to put their stuff every time there's a proposal for a hygiene center or that would have lockers, among other facilities. It's controversial. Neighbors oppose it. So, I mean, I think that it does get to the question of compassion. And if we say that we care about the people who are the least fortunate among us, are we willing to have them actually among us and storing their belongings among us and living among us? And for a lot of people, I think the answer is no. And for the city, I think that it's a question of pushing back against that and saying, you know, we have this problem and we need to deal with it. And we're going to build, you know, 10 more encampments, and we're going to build lockers throughout the city so people don't have to carry their stuff with them everywhere. And I think that's going to take a real show of will by the city, and it's going to take pushing back on this kind of reflexive NIMBYism that says, I care about homeless people, but I don't want them anywhere near me.
Hey, Gioma?
Yeah, I agree. I do think that we need to change the way in which we look at our homeless population. These are our neighbors. These are community members. These are not unwanted guests. They are Seattleites, just like the rest of us, and they deserve to be here. I think
it feels like we're talking about immigrants right now.
Yeah, it's true. And I think that, you know, Seattle likes to say that they are very liberal, but it only applies to a certain subset that they would feel comfortable sitting around a table with. And we really do have to challenge that. These people live in Seattle, and this is one of the most difficult cities to live in. It's one of the most expensive cities to live in. And people are being treated like trash. Just the thought of sweeping people out of a place is just a horrible way to look at it. And the fact that the city was using prison labor to do this last year is also absolutely horrific. Using one disenfranchised population to displace another is so gross. I can't even fully put it into words. And I think we need to challenge the way we look at that. I also think the city really needs to look at not only the NIMBYism around camps, but also the NIMBYism around things like methadone clinics, which also does dictate where many homeless people can stay. We have very few. I think we only have 1 methadone clinic in Seattle. I live near one in the North End and in the Shoreline area right on the border. And the truth is that if you are required to go there every day, you have to live near it. And there are no homeless facilities. There are not enough homeless facilities nearby. There are not enough methadone clinics nearby. And that's something we need to look at as well. We need to look at the entirety of Seattle populations as people. And this means we need to look at not only the way we look at homelessness, affordable housing, jobs, but also the way we look at, you know, drug use in the city and drug treatment in the city as well.
It seems like we have a state of emergency declared. We have a relatively popular mayor who could put facilities in places where it's controversial, as you said. But is there something else the city could realistically do to ameliorate the concerns of these neighbors, to on the trash, the needles, we want our parks, you know, our children to play football in safe places? There's something, what more? Erica, you can't wait to speak.
I'm like jumping up and down.
Okay, what's the thing?
Well, it's not one thing, but I do think that SPU has acknowledged that they have not done an adequate job of providing dumpsters and going out and picking up the actual garbage.
Seattle Public Utilities. Why would that be?
I think it's a question of resources and priorities. I've heard people say, how can they generate so much garbage? Imagine if you didn't have somebody coming to your house every week, picking up your recycling, picking up your compost, picking up your trash, and it just had to pile up in your backyard and you had to live among it.
There are listeners saying that the people who created that are the people who should clean it up. You know that.
But you don't do that yourself. I mean, that it's a city service.
I haul it a few feet over the curb.
You take it out to the bin, yeah.
So I don't buy that argument. And I think that the city does have a responsibility to do cleanups of actual trash. I also think, to the question of needles, the city has proposed citing, I think, 10 Sharps facilities throughout the city. And actually, 4 of them already exist. So really, 6 new boxes. I could be a little off on those numbers, but it's just a handful. And that is totally inadequate. I think there should be Sharps containers at every library, every public building. And I think that it is a testament to the power of NIMBYism that, you know, that people like the mayor, who is fairly popular, you know, hear that and they say, okay, we'll do this incredibly incremental step, which of course isn't going to solve the problem of people finding needles in parks and in bushes. And that's what freaks people out. And the city has a responsibility to do something about that and to actually work to clean that up instead of just saying, you know, we throwing up their hands and sweeping everything and throwing away people's sleeping bags, which is what they do now.
You know, I like the word NIMBYism, and I'm just concerned that we're not going to get a chance to use it again this hour. We've only got a few minutes left. And one more topic to cover. So it's just, I mean, we'll see. I just can't guarantee to the listener that a sense of entitlement is going to come up in the rest of this show. Well, who knows? We got one more topic left. We'll do that in a moment. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Ijeoma Oluo and Erica C. Barnett and Canute Berger. Who feels sorry for Mercer Island? This week, the Mercer Island City Council voted to sue Sound Transit and the state because when they start building light rail across I-90, Mercer Islanders, of which I am one, will lose a privilege or a right, depending on who you believe. Here's the deal. Back in the 70s, the state and the feds expanded I-90. You might correct me on the dates, Canute, but the freeway was widened, and for Mercer Island that meant more freeway, but also more noise and exhaust, and Mercer Island and traffic, and Mercer Island got stuff in return, like a park over the freeway, and to the point today, special access to the carpool lanes. You might not even know this, but Mercer Islanders driving solo, as I do, can get on the express lanes, which are otherwise for carpools only. That deal will end this summer because when they start building light rail across I-90, the express lanes will be gone. The carpool lane will shift over to the regular I-90 lanes. Well, Mercer Islanders want to keep using those too, even for solo drivers. And the state said, no, you've been getting a special waiver that wasn't guaranteed forever. We are growing. We're congesting. It's time to get on the bus, get on the carpool. Canute, you're our historian here. Is that about it? Is there other background that we need to know to get this, to understand that?
Well, one thing, let me just say that the I-90 project was conceived when Kennedy was president and wasn't completed until the Clinton administration. In other words, there were decades of fighting over the design and plan. This is pre-WSDOT, started with the State Highway Department.
Not just Mercer Island fight.
Not just Mercer Island. There were fights all along the way. And in fact, in some ways, Mercer Island actually... they're fighting I-90, ended up helping Seattle get a much better project than was originally conceived of. I mean, the original I-90 expansion, you know, built a new bridge, widened I-90 dramatically, no lids, you know, went through the Central District, was going to meet up with the R.H. Thompson Expressway, and so the entire Judkins Park area was going to be this massive multi-freeway interchange. Yeah, where Erica lives. And there was pushback from the wealthy white suburbs of Mercer Island. They were able to negotiate a lid and special access. And the Seattle, and particularly Mount Baker in the central area, rebelled and said, we're not going to permit the highway, you know, through here, and we're able to get a lid, and Royer got transit lanes onto I-90. Wes Ullman got a bike tunnel built through the Mount Baker Ridge. There were a lot of benefits in those
neighborhoods. There's a long, dignified history of suing the
there is. No, I was going to say, makers. I mean, if you're talking about is there precedent for suing over these issues, there absolutely is, and in many cases, the lawsuits generated a better project.
Okay, but yes, you're pointing your finger. You want to finish?
Yeah, well, I just want to go back. So, but the people who negotiated the Mercer Island access said that was only a temporary deal.
That's
and
the
key. Course, it's gone on for years. People have come to expect it, and on the legitimate side, it is an island. There are ways that it is difficult to mitigate the loss of something like that.
Can we get a ferry dock on Mercer Island?
And I was just going to say, though, part of the problem is what Aubrey Davis, who was the mayor of Mercer Island when the I-90 project was going on, and he said the problem with Mercer Islanders is they want a new freeway, but they don't want to see it, they don't want to hear it, and they don't want to smell it.
Erica, can we agree that we can't stand Mercer Islanders? Can we agree on that much?
Some of my favorite radio hosts are Mercer Islanders. I think that to bring this up to the present, what Mercer Islanders are arguing for now is not just that they should have special access, continue to have special access to HOV lanes. They also, and to Knut's point about sort of not of wanting light rail but not wanting to see it, hear it, smell it, etc., they want to keep off island people from essentially using the transit that comes to them. So they want to prevent all bus transfers on the island of metro buses. They want to have Islander-only parking at the new park and ride for light rail.
Well, not only Islanders can park there, but if you live on the island, because right now you can't get into that parking area after like 6:30, the park and ride. So they want to have, like, you live here, you get a pass, because it's the last free stop for the entire east side coming to Seattle. Oh my gosh, listen to me. I'm just pointing that out.
Okay, so they want that. And they have also talked about having their own reserved special seats on the buses and the trains.
What?
As part of this conversation.
Gold-plated.
Not making that up. And so my sympathy is diminished a little bit by the sense of privilege that these folks are saying. And just listening to the meeting the other day, I mean, people comparing themselves to, quote, the Dakota Access Line tribe, which I think we can translate that.
We're the water protectors in Mercer Island.
You know, because they chose to live on an island that has a freeway that's the only way in and out.
Okay.
The rock and standing rock in
there,
solidarity.
See? It's the rock. Okay, we just have 1 minute. Ijeoma, do you want to say something before we stop making fun of me?
I have a little bit of sympathy in the fact that it is an island, right? And you start thinking about logistics, but the truth is they actually live in the Pacific Northwest. The traffic realities of the Pacific Northwest are not something they're ever going to be
insulated
from.
Yeah, right.
And honestly, if that's the biggest problem in your life is that your $1 million home is a little bit harder to get to and from, you live quite a charmed life.
Yes,
I would love that to be.
A lot of people don't know that every home on Mercer Island is on the waterfront and is worth millions, in fact, billions of dollars. That's underreported. Okay, that's just real news. Print that. Okay,
that's your story.
Yeah, that's my story. Ijeoma Oluo, Knut Berger, Erica C. Barnett. The C is for Crank.com and Crosscut in Seattle Magazine brings us Knut Berger. Ijeoma is the editor at large at The Establishment. And I love you all. Thank you for this.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks
for tuning in.